Okay, there we are, on the air. Tuesday night Bible study on Romans. We're going to do chapter 14 tonight. And so just a very brief recap of chapter 13. Chapter 13 was all about submission to the authorities. So we're in these last few chapters of Romans where Paul is giving practical advice on how to live out the Christian life. What, because we've been justified freely by Christ, therefore, what? What do we do? And so he's been given various advice. And chapter 13 was about submission to authorities. Notice that doesn't mean necessarily that we obey authorities. I don't know if you remember I said that. Because sometimes the authorities can be corrupt. That is true. So we recognize we're still in submission to authorities, even though maybe on occasion we disobey the authorities, especially when they contradict God's word. This was the exact conundrum that Christians, including Lutherans, at the time of the American Revolution had. You know, do they submit to King George, or do they rebel against him, the revolution? So, it's actually, among Lutherans who were in America at that time, it split them. Some were saying, yes, we should. Some were saying, no, we don't like the fact that he's taxing us to taxation without representation, but it's not against the Bible, so we should still be loyal to the king. So, it was a big conundrum for them back then. And then Paul said near the end of chapter 13, owe no one anything. Do not owe anything. Pay honor to those to whom you owe honor, respect to respect, revenue to revenue, etc. And live upstanding lives. Live a life that is publicly noteworthy. Okay? Which kind of goes along with, if you're living an upstanding godly life, you need not fear the authorities. Okay? Any thoughts or questions about chapter 13 from last week? Alright, now he's starting another kind of new topic. So chapter 14 is a new topic, again, within the realm of how to live your Christian life, how to live out the fact that we are justified freely for Christ's sake. And so, let me get started on this, chapter 14. It's not super long, I think we can get through the whole thing in one class. So, 14 chapter 1. As for the one who is weak in faith, welcome him, but not to quarrel over opinions. One person believes he may eat anything, while the weak person eats only vegetables. Let not the one who eats despise the one who abstains, and let not the one who abstains pass judgment on the one who eats, for God has welcomed him. Who are you to pass judgment on the servant of another? It is before his own master that he stands or falls, and he will be upheld, for the Lord is able to make him stand. All right, first of all, I want to read, as an opening to all of chapter 14, a little commentary from Martin Luther. This is from the Lutheran Study Bible. So in the footnotes there for chapter 14, Luther says this. In chapter 14, Paul teaches that consciences weak in faith are to be led gently, spared, so that we do not use our Christian freedom for doing harm, but for the assistance of the weak. For where that is not done, the result is discord and contempt for the gospel. And the gospel is the all-important thing. Thus, it is better to yield a little to the weak in faith until they grow stronger than to have the teaching of the gospel come to nothing. And this work is a peculiar work of love, for which there is great need even now, when with the eating of meat and other liberties, men are rudely and roughly and needlessly shaking weak consciences before they know the truth. Okay? So those who are stronger in faith or understand their liberties should relinquish those liberties and be willing to refrain from those liberties for the sake of those who are weak in conscience. That's what Luther is saying, and that's kind of the gist of what Paul is saying here. But let's go through it a little bit more in detail. As for the one who is weak in faith, welcome him, but not to quarrel over opinions. If somebody joins our church, and we have people joining our church, actually, we're about to have 5 adult confirmands coming up in the next few weeks, so that's pretty neat. But these are people, I've been teaching them, kind of an adult confirmation class, I've been teaching them, and some of them were never Christian. Some of them were Christian, but in a different denomination. And so there's various levels of understanding of Scripture and doctrine and God. Okay? So we don't want to welcome them in and then all of a sudden bombard them with things that they don't understand or that would affect their conscience. Okay, so that's one thing that we who are stronger in faith, we should accommodate those who are weaker in faith. Not to quarrel over opinions, Paul says. As Luther said, the gospel is what's most important. I have used this argument before with Christians, some in our church and some elsewhere, that just because you can do something in Christian freedom doesn't mean you should if it harms the conscience of someone else. Okay? So in a minute, as we go through this paragraph, I'm going to ask for maybe a little discussion. We're going to have some discussion time today on some examples, modern day examples of what that might be. All right? But the gospel is what's most important. Above all, we don't want to hurt the proclamation of the gospel, somebody listening. If they're so offended that you use your Christian liberty to drink alcohol when they think alcohol is bad, that they stop listening to the gospel message, well, then for a time, you shouldn't drink when you're with them so that they are open-minded about hearing the gospel. That's just one example. All right. And then Paul says, one person believes he may eat anything while the weak person eats only vegetables. Notice Paul is already making an assumption there on which is stronger and which is weaker. It's kind of written in there, because somebody could say, well, just because I'm a vegetarian doesn't mean I'm the weak one. I'm the strong one, because I know it's not proper to eat meat. Well, from a Christian perspective, God gave us meat to eat. After Noah. See, I don't know if you know this. So here's a little teaching on this, because this is a little bit in the commentaries. This ties in with what Paul was teaching in Corinthians. They had this problem in Corinthians. So you hear this same topic over in that other letter. Prior to the time of Noah, and from the time of Adam and Eve, God said, you may eat anything from the fruit of the trees that bears its seed within it. That's what he told Adam and Eve. So it can be understood that Adam and Eve were vegetarians. They ate fruit and vegetables only. Then, when Noah and his family came off the ark, God specifically says, the clean animals, and he defined what that was, are now available for you to eat as food as well. Does it mean you have to eat meat? No. Does it mean you can eat meat? Yes. And I, for one, am glad for that. Because the burgers at Sandbar are excellent. Or, you know, to throw a steak on the grill is a wonderful thing. Or bacon. Yeah. Bacon makes everything better. So, do you have to eat meat? No. Can you eat meat? Yes. Well, in this modern culture, there are a lot of people who don't want to eat meat because of animal rights issues. Okay? Now, for me, I think that's kind of silly. But if I'm in the presence of somebody, like maybe one of these new members coming in, and I find out that they're a vegetarian, I'm going to refrain from eating meat while I'm with them so as not to cause them to be offended and leave the church while we're just trying to get them into the church. Does that make sense? Absolutely, it makes sense. So this whole idea of eating meat or not eating meat still applies today. Still applies today. So one person believes he may eat anything while the weak person eats only vegetables. So the one who thinks they should only eat vegetables is the weaker Christian. But we accommodate that idea while they're growing in faith, and eventually they might come to the understanding that, oh yeah, God does allow us to eat meat, so I can have a burger if I want, or a turkey sandwich, or pulled pork, or barbecued ribs, or, should I keep going?
A meat platter.
Yeah, right, a meat platter. Let not the one, verse 3, let not the one who eats despise the one who abstains, and let not the one who abstains pass judgment on the one who eats, for God has welcomed him. Now, that him at the end of verse 3, who is that referring to? That's the one who abstains. But I would say that this is me interjecting. This is not actually part of the grammar here. For God has welcomed him refers to both. The person who eats and the person who eats meat and the person who doesn't eat meat. God has welcomed them both. So verse 3 is saying, don't judge one another. So just because you eat meat, don't look down your nose at those who are vegetarians. And if you're a vegetarian, Don't look at the people who eat meat as though they're doing something wrong or sinful, because it is allowed. So don't judge one another. Boy, does that sound familiar? Does Jesus talk about that in a numerous number of places? Judge not, lest you be judged. Oh boy, that is hard to do. I have to say, for me too, because I see somebody's actions. I see the way somebody appears, you know, at Meijer or whatever, and I see the, you know, certain dress or certain haircut or, well, I'll tell you one that I just saw recently was a lady with her hair shaved all on the sides, so it was like a mohawk, and the top part was dyed teal. And she was an elderly lady, I would say, in her 60s. And I'm looking at this and saying, why? And then I have to catch myself and say, don't judge, you're not supposed to judge. You know, maybe she's a Christian, I don't know. Couldn't tell. Alright. It's hard. It's hard to not pass judgment. But yet, that's one of the things we're called to do by Paul, by Jesus, by others.
Doesn't that go against our very nature? Because I was just thinking about this today. The exact same stuff about hair and stuff. As part of our DNA to be, so we protect ourselves from danger, guarding a situation if somebody looks suspicious. And
yeah.
So you may attribute those physical features to that person that they're a danger to you.
Yeah.
So you're actually going against what your protective instincts.
Sure, sure. Yeah, I agree. And we do have that instinct to kind of look at people a certain way or judge them based on appearances, which we shouldn't. Yeah.
Apparently they did it in Paul's time too.
Yes, they did in Paul's time too. And I don't remember where it was. Paul talked about if you let the rich person and you seat them to a seat of honor in the congregation, but the poor person you say, you stand over there in the corner, and Paul chastises them and says, you can't do that, you're showing partiality. And so there's yet another time where you're not supposed to judge people by appearances or other things too.
But this reading would indicate that it's a sin?
No, it's not. You mean to eat vegetables or eat meat?
To judge others.
Oh, to judge others is a sin. Yes. To judge others. We shouldn't be judging one another. Right, which is a hard thing. So, Lord, forgive me for having judgmental thoughts about the appearance of my fellow man. Yeah. Right.
The eighth commandment?
Yeah, perhaps. It's in there somewhere.
top 10,
yeah, it's in the top 10, right.
Well, I know it's not loving your neighbor.
That's true. That's true.
That's not Christ's command. I suppose you could apply it there.
Yeah, you could. Alright, verse 4, who are you to pass judgment on the servant of another? It is before his own master that he stands or falls. So, if the other person is Christian, you know they're Christian. And they know you're Christian. That actually elevates the whole problem of judging one another. Because if you're judging a non-Christian based on a sinful action, that actually is something we should do, preaching the law. So if somebody is committing something sinful, you remind them, I would say gently, that that's sinful in God's eyes. But when you're doing something that's not sinful, but one person does it and the other person doesn't, like eating meat, like being a, well, carnivore or a vegetarian, okay? It's neither commanded nor forbidden. So, especially for another Christian, you don't pass judgment on them. It is before his own master. And who is his master? Jesus. Jesus is your master. It's before Jesus that you stand or fall. It's not before your fellow Christian. So, I said neither commanded nor forbidden. Some of you know this word because this is part of what Paul is talking about here. It's a Latin word. It's adiaphora. Have some of you heard that before? I know a few of you have at least. Adiaphora. It means neither commanded nor forbidden. So it's free for a Christian to do it or not do it. Did God ever command us to only eat vegetables after the time of Noah? No. Did God tell us we have to eat meat? No. So eating meat or not eating meat is adiaphora. You can do it or not. It's not a sin. Either way. So that's the example Paul is using here. Okay? So it is before Jesus, that you will be judged and stand or fall, and so he wants you to follow your conscience. Paul's going to get into that here in just a minute. And he will be upheld, for the Lord is able to make him stand. So everybody, Jesus will uphold everyone in their faith as long as you follow your conscience. So a person who only eats vegetables because their conscience says, well, that's really what I should do, I would support them in that. Follow your conscience. A person who eats meat because that's what their conscience says that they're allowed to do, follow your conscience. I would not let a vegetarian bully a carnivore into giving up meat when God allows it. Nor the other way. I would not say a carnivore. Should I be saying carnivore? Is there a better word? A meat eater? I don't know. I have this image of dinosaurs. You know, carnivores.
A carny.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Omnivore. Yeah, that's what we are. We eat everything, right? Well, I do anyway. I don't know about you guys.
So only eating donuts all the time is okay.
Yes. Donuts is okay. Right. Exactly. So, for a little bit of a field trip tonight, this is tonight's scheduled field trip, the only one I have, I want to have a little bit of discussion. Can you think of other topics? Paul's going to mention two more. So there's three in chapter 14 that he's going to bring up. Topics, items, issues that are adiaphora, neither commanded nor forbidden. You can do it or not do it, or participate, or eat it, or consume it, or whatever, or not. You're free to do either, but you should not judge somebody who has the opposite opinion from you. Can you think of anything else?
Wearing or not wearing masks?
Okay, I guess we could say that. It's not in the Bible at all, so we shouldn't judge somebody else who wears a mask or somebody else who doesn't wear a mask. Now, unfortunately, through COVID, there was some politics involved in that, which messed up the whole thing, because some people said, not only do I want to wear a mask, I want you to wear a mask. So they were imposing upon someone else. And then other people said, not only do I not want to wear a mask, I want you to not wear a mask. So then, yeah, it was a mess. But yeah, I would say wearing a mask, especially now, when we're kind of in a phase where everybody realizes masks have marginal effectiveness, and we've got some treatments for COVID, and so we're kind of, yeah. Right now, I would say that would be a topic of this, right? We should not judge one another based on if you wear a mask or not wear a mask. Yeah. Any other thoughts?
Works-oriented denominations. Some say dancing is a sin. Others say no.
Yeah.
Movie theater. Smoking.
Smoking, there's a good one. Movie theater, you mean some denominations would say you can't go to the movies?
I know of a member that I had a discussion with one time. They told me they couldn't go see a movie. This was a Christian-based movie.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that? It's a Christian-based movie. Well, it's a sin to go there because people don't know what movie you're going to see. They just see you walking in. So
wow.
It's a sin.
Yeah, that's. I would say that's a weaker Christian. So, yeah, because we can go see movies, certainly. But for a person like that has a very delicate conscience. So how do you dance around that and say, well, you know, maybe I should watch the movies at home so that I don't give somebody the impression that I'm going to an R-rated movie when I'm really not. That was that what that person's...
No, I wouldn't say that they were a weak Christian. I think they're just misinterpreting scripture.
Okay.
That's how I feel, because he was strong in Bible study. He was an older gentleman.
Okay. Well, I would say smoking is one of those, actually. You might be shocked to hear that. God doesn't say anything about smoking or not smoking. You can make the case that you should not participate in smoking because it harms your body. True enough. We know it leads to lung cancer if you smoke too much or too long. But I do also know, I've known some people who smoke socially occasionally. It's not an addictive habit, which again it can be, so that would be bad. If it becomes an addiction, it's bad. But just occasional cigarette or a cigar with the fellas or something like that, there's nothing for it or against it. God doesn't say one way or another. You mentioned dancing. Yeah, that's another one I guess I would say. You know, David, King David danced. That's in one of the, it's in the Old Testament. So is dancing allowed? Yeah, absolutely dancing is allowed.
Not in the Baptist church.
Not in the Baptist church is true. So if you're around somebody who's grew up Baptist and maybe is now joining our church, maybe you don't go out to a dance club with them for a little while till they grow stronger in faith, right? You accommodate the weaker conscience. Yes. So, you know, in a certain situation, dancing would be one of those topics. What else? Anything, any other thoughts?
Alcohol.
Yeah, alcohol. Again, there are numerous Christian groups, denominations that would say any alcohol is bad. And of course, what's our Lutheran position? We have Bible studies on wine. of course, Paul does say, many places it says drunkenness is a sin, but it doesn't say drinking is a sin. So there's our Christian freedom. Can you have a drink or two? Yes. A glass of wine, a bottle of beer, a mixed drink? Yes, as long as you're in control and it's, you know, one or two or whatever your limit is, you're fine. Jesus turned water into wine after all, but getting drunk is a sin. Now that's the truth. However, some Christians are weaker in conscience and they think any alcohol is a sin. So if I'm around a person like that, I would order tea or coffee until they grow in faith and understanding and become stronger. Okay? So yes, that's a good one. Any other thoughts?
Women wearing makeup and jewelry.
I didn't know that was an issue.
I think that jewelry is.
Really? In some Christian circles?
Yeah.
Wow. Well, it's a good thing I got my earrings out. They're the clip-on kind, though. I did get my ears pierced.
I brought some friends to church one time, and they were aghast that we had a liturgy and we read from our prayers from the book.
You okay?
They didn't think that was very Christian.
They didn't think it was Christian. I think I know where you're going. There are some Christians who think reciting set prayers, like the Lord's Prayer, is wrong, and that you should pray from the heart.
Right.
You should pray extemporaneously, just however the Spirit moves you.
And worship the same way. To have a liturgy was to interrupt kind of spiritual flow.
Yeah, right. I have encountered Christians like that, and they say, well, that's not a good practice to pray the Lord's Prayer, because you're just reciting it over and over again. You're not actually praying what is on your heart to pray.
Yeah.
And my answer to that was, Jesus' disciples asked him to teach them to pray, and he said, pray like this. So if that comes from Jesus, I think we're on good standing.
The Bible doesn't say you have to have a liturgy, but, you know, there's plenty of examples.
Right. Right. And actually, you'll notice, for me, I start the Bible study with an extemporaneous prayer, where I'm just praying for whatever your requests are, and how do we finish? With a pre-written prayer. The Lord's Prayer. So we do both, right? Yes, that's another example. You're right. Anything else?
What about gambling? Now, it used to be that the Catholic Church did bingo with money. Mm-hmm.
I would put gambling in that same category as smoking or drinking. That it's not forbidden. And there was, I mean, some people would say that they, in numerous places in the Bible, they cast lots. So that's like throwing dice. I would say what's wrong is if somebody is gambling with money they can't afford to lose, or if somebody's addicted to it. So if you drink too much and you're addicted to it, i.e. an alcoholic, that's bad. If you smoke too much and you're addicted to it, that harms your body, that's bad. If you gamble too much and you're addicted to it, that's bad. But I used to play poker with some guys at work once a month. We'd each bring 10 or 20 bucks, get some chips, and, you know, play poker for a little bit. That was gambling, sort of, but, I mean, very small. And none of us were gambling addicts. So I would still defend that as being okay. So I think it's not forbidden or commanded. So, but again, if somebody says, all gambling is wrong, well, okay, I'm not going to play cards around you then. Do it some other time. Play with my wife. We play gin rummy. Occasionally cribbage. All right. Anything else?
Tattoos.
I was just going to say, one that's on the top of my list that no one mentioned yet is tattoos. You're right. Does God forbid tattoos? Well, some say that in the Old Testament, and he does, he forbids marring your body. So is a tattoo marring your body? Yeah, maybe. However, did Jesus do away with all the Old Testament ceremonial laws? Not the moral laws, but the ceremonial laws? Yes, he did. He fulfilled them all. Can you have a tattoo today? I actually know lots of pastors who have tattoos. So I would say this, if it's respectable, if it's not something vulgar, it's not something, you know, I don't know, satanic or whatever, a goat's head or a, you know, a pentastar or whatever, it's probably okay. You know, I've seen pastors with Christian tattoos, and they use it as a way to open a conversation with somebody, you know, who's in a certain demographic, shall we say. So I would say the same thing, that, you know, tattoos are kind of in that same category. I agree. I don't happen to have one. I have no interest in getting one. But I know some people do. Any other thoughts, other topics, other things? Here's what I've got. I briefly did a little bit of brainstorming in my own head. Drinking alcohol, smoking, tattoos, wearing masks. I had that on my list too. And here's one that nobody's mentioned yet. Guns. Right? Does God forbid us to have guns? No, he tells his disciples at one point, go out and buy a sword. That was a deadly weapon. But are some people afraid of guns or say, no, you shouldn't carry guns, or we should, you know, outlaw guns or confiscate guns or whatever? It's neither commanded nor forbidden. So you have to be sensitive around people who might not understand the freedom we have regarding weapons. Okay? All right. Here's some topics that are not adiaphora, meaning freedom, Christian freedom, but some Christians think they are, that it is Christian freedom, but it's really not. The definition of marriage. Oh yeah, it doesn't matter what you think. You can define marriage however you want. Well, no, that's not adiaphora. That's not Christian freedom. God has defined marriage in the Bible. And there's only one definition. One man and one woman. That's the definition of marriage. Now, society can pretend that they can redefine marriage, but according to God, they're not redefining marriage. They're corrupting it. Okay? So there is a topic where people think they have freedom, but they really don't. And a lot of Christian groups, denominations understand that. Here's another one where we would dispute with a lot of our fellow Christians. Closed communion. Communion practices. There are a lot of Christian denominations out there that say, you should be able to take communion at any church you want. That's not what Paul says. Paul says very specifically in 1 Corinthians 10, when you commune at a church, you are uniting yourself to that church and all of its teachings. So if you commune at another church, you're making a public statement before God and those people that you agree with what they teach. Well, that's not true. If you're Lutheran and you're at a non-Lutheran church for some event, a wedding, a funeral, or whatever, and they happen to have baptism, which very few churches have communion at those types of events anyway, but that's not a Christian freedom. Paul very specifically says, you know, gives us direction on that. And I got one more in here that some people think is Christian freedom, and so you can define it any way you want, and it doesn't matter. Ordination. Some people say, well, there's nothing wrong with having women pastors or having homosexuals ordained. Oh, well, God does have definitions on that too, for various reasons. So we don't have Christian freedom in that, even though some people think we do. Does that make sense? So we have to separate issues which are not defined by God in the Bible, such as drinking, smoking, tattoos, etc. They're not specifically defined for or against. Or, to get back to Paul's example, eating meat. You can eat meat or not eat meat. Either way is fine. But you need to be conscious of what your neighbor thinks, so that you're not offending somebody else and harming the gospel message. Okay?
What about praying with people of other faiths?
I
had a Muslim friend.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't pray together.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's a little sticky one there. Because on the one hand, we should not pray with non-Christians. We would say that. I think, I'd have to do a little research. I don't know of offhand any passages in the Bible that tell us to avoid praying with people of false religions. But there's probably some in there. However, there are many Christians who will not pray with people of another denomination. And we would say it's okay to pray with other Christians, but you should not pray with people from false religions like Muslims or Buddhists or Hindus or whatever. You should avoid praying with them. So that's where the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod draws the line. But as many of you know, Wells draws the line differently. Other denominations draw the line differently. So you picked on one issue that I'd never thought of that's kind of in between. Is it commanded in the Bible? Sort of, but not really. Is it forbidden in the Bible? Sort of, but not really. I mean, that's a good question. That's a good question. I stick with what our church, the LCMS says, that it's okay to pray with other Christians. It's not okay to pray with non-Christians from a false religion. Good question. Any other questions or comments?
For ordination, what does the Bible require or teach about becoming a pastor or minister or whatever?
Well, that's a long question. There are some guidelines that Paul gives to Timothy and also in Titus as well, so the pastoral epistles, as to who's capable of or qualified to be a pastor. And yes, one of them is a man. So yes, and there's theological reasons behind that, by the way. Because a pastor is supposed to represent Jesus. Jesus was a man. A pastor is supposed to be the leader of the congregation, much like a father is supposed to be a leader in the family. So for that reason, again. And there's some other theological reasons behind it as well. But then Paul does define in those two places all the characteristics that a pastor should be above repute, he should be a man of wisdom, he should have patience, he should not be a lover of money. You know, he talks about all these things. And so, actually, in order to get into the seminary, you go through an interview to make sure that I was compatible with those things. And to graduate from the seminary, you go through another interview with the seminary staff and with the district and the synod to make sure that you understand and agree with the doctrine, the teaching that you've been taught. So there is a significant screening process, really. Did I answer your question?
No.
Okay. Thank you for being honest. Ask it again.
All right. I can go on the internet and there are sites there that, send us $25 and we'll make you an official minister of something.
Yeah.
So, where do they fit in?
Oh, that's a complete misunderstanding of the concept of ordination. My wife has a cousin who got married, and they're kind of nutty crunchy anyway, kind of on the edge of things, culturally speaking. And they wanted to be married by a close friend of theirs in an art museum. We went to the wedding. And Jill is saying, Marty, calm down. Just, don't get too excited. Don't get all upset about it. Actually I'm not. Because they just don't understand the definition of ordination And they're kind of abusing the understanding of marriage as well. Because they claim that their friend got ordained on the internet. And my answer to Jill, and maybe a few of her close family members, was there really wasn't an ordination on the internet. Because ordination means you have been set apart by a religious institution for a certain purpose. That's what the word ordination means. So, can the internet set you apart for a religious purpose? No. Actually, what they did is they got licensed by the state of Michigan to perform a wedding. That's what they did. But I got ordained on the internet. No, well, you can call it that, but that's not really what happened. You were licensed by the state of Michigan, and it was a secular wedding. Okay, judges can do secular weddings. So I said, you know what? I told Jill, I said, other than the fact that they misused the word ordination, it's a legal wedding. Completely non-Christian, but it's a legal wedding. They signed a marriage license and they got married in the eyes of the state of Michigan. And frankly, they already had a kid. So I thought, you know, it's better that they're married than not married. So I'm kind of happy that they're actually getting married, even though it's not in the church and not by a pastor and not and nothing Christian about it. But at least they're getting married.
What about the non-denominational churches?
They're not actually non-denominational. They actually are a denomination. And there's an association of them that they support one another, much like we do in our synod. So the whole idea that there is such a thing as an independent, non-denominational church, it's kind of a fallacy. Because there actually is a group of non-denominational churches, which make up a denomination. Does that make sense? So, although if you really wanted to get down to it, you could say an individual congregation that is completely standalone and unassociated with any other denomination. They're not part of Lutherans, Baptists, Methodists, Catholics, anything else. They're just their own one single congregation. Well, you could define that as a church body. And so they can ordain somebody who's been properly trained and for the purpose of ministering to the word within that church. That would be an ordination. So, okay. Wow, sorry. Did I finally answer your question, maybe? Yeah. Sort of?
Yeah.
Okay.
Cleared up a lot.
All right. I can answer more after class if you need, so. All right. Should we go onward? One person esteems one day as better than another, while another esteems all days alike. Each one should be fully convinced in his own mind. The one who observes the day observes it in honor of the Lord. The one who eats, eats in honor of the Lord, since he gives thanks to God, while the one who abstains, abstains in honor of the Lord and gives thanks to God. For none of us lives to himself, and none of us dies to himself. For if we live to the Lord. If we die, we die to the Lord. So then, whether we live or whether we die, we are the Lord's. For to this end, Christ died and lived again, that he might be Lord both of the dead and of the living. So there's the second topic that Paul brings up as one of these adiaphora, neither commanded nor forbidden, and that is the observance of days. So this comes from the fact that the early church was dominated by Jews. And what did they think about Saturday?
Sabbath.
The Sabbath. And so even though they were now Christians, the first round of Christians were Jewish of nature, and they said, okay, so on Saturday you can't do any work. Well, Jesus is Lord of the Sabbath. He fulfilled the Sabbath. The Sabbath is no longer necessary as a ceremonial law. As a moral law, yes, you should have a day of rest sometime during the week. Just as an example, I asked my oldest son tonight, who is still working at Meijer. He's doing okay there. He's finally getting his sights set on something further as a career, so that's good. But I said, Andrew, did you clean your bathroom downstairs? He lives in the basement. Did you clean your bathroom downstairs yet? He said, I will when it's my weekend. He has Wednesdays and Thursdays off. But he works Friday through Tuesday, so weekends as well. So his weekend is Wednesday and Thursday. I knew exactly what he meant. I said, okay, so tomorrow you're going to clean your bathroom, right? Because it's a mess. I peeked in there when I was doing laundry. He said, yeah, clean the bathroom. So, does it matter where your weekend is? No. Does it matter which day you worship God? No. Ooh, this still has some modern day implications, doesn't it? Because what do we have right down the road in Berrien Springs? A whole mess of Seventh-day Adventists. And they claim it's sinful to worship on any day other than Saturday. They actually claim that. Well, if we had a Seventh-day Adventist who got attracted to, joined, married into, moved, or whatever came into our church, I would very gently have to try to deal with their conscience that we worship on Sunday or on Thursday. And so, you try to accommodate the weaker conscience. That's what Paul is talking about here. So one person esteems one day as better than another, another esteems them all alike. So again, the stronger person who understands Christian freedom needs to try to accommodate the weaker person so as not to harm the gospel message. So that's what he's talking about. The one who eats, eats in honor of the Lord. He gives thanks to God. The one who eats meat, that's what he's talking about there. And the one who abstains from meat, abstains in honor of the Lord. So again, you can't pass judgment on each other. You're both doing what you think is right in your conscience, and you're doing it to try to give honor to God. Now one is actually making use of Christian freedom and the other one is foregoing Christian freedom, but you should not judge one another in those regards from either eating or from abstaining in meat. And then right here, verses 7, 8, and 9, this is a nice little commentary that Paul is making on this whole topic. For none of us lives to himself and none of us dies to himself. No one's a hermit. We are part of a big, giant community. In fact, that's a big, giant family. One of the confirmands, the adult confirmands that I'm teaching right now, asked me a question. I said, ask any question anytime. We're going through Lutheranism 101. She asked me a question. She said, who did Adam and Eve's kids marry? You guys heard this question before? No? Some of you have, some of you haven't. And I said, well, they married their brothers and sisters. Siblings married and had kids. It wasn't until the time of Abraham that God forbid marriage between siblings. And actually, you can recognize there's some scientific reason behind that. Why is marriage between siblings or cousins forbidden in America and most countries today? Why is that forbidden? It's a very practical scientific reason to prevent birth defects. Because two people that are too closely related, if you get married and have babies, there's a much higher chance of birth defects. It's just a biological thing. So God gave that command to Abraham. Prior to that, it was okay. So, and then her answer was, so you mean we're actually all have the same, the exact same great, 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 times 100 great, great, great grandparents, Adam and Eve? I said, yes. If you go far enough back, we are all related. We are one family. The human family. And she's like, wow. That kind of makes sense. And I said, it's true. Yeah, we're all one family. So, whoops, how did that come up on the screen? So, none of us lives to himself, none of us dies to himself. We are all part of one family. We're all related. That might be good, that might be bad. Depending on who you're thinking about. I don't want to be related to those people, but I want to be related to those people. For if we live, we live to the Lord. If we die, we die to the Lord. So there again, we're connected to Christ in everything. We're connected to Christ and we're connected to each other. You know what this screams in my head as a Lutheran pastor? Communion. When you take communion, you're connected to Christ and he's connected to you. And you're connected to everyone else at that table. Right? You're all connected to each other. That's what's going on here. If we live, we live to the Lord. If we die, we die to the Lord. Whether we live or we die, We are the Lord's. Actually, that's a bit of comforting information there. It's a nice little gospel note, isn't it? You're always connected with Jesus. Jesus was abandoned on the cross. He was disconnected from God the Father and all humanity. He was abandoned on the cross. You and I will never be abandoned. We're always connected to God and to Christ. For to this end, Christ died and lived again, that he might be Lord both of the dead and the living. Now, the commentary that I've been reading from Dr. Middendorf, he makes a comment about this verse. For to this end Christ died and lived again. Most commonly, Paul, throughout his letters, says Christ died and rose again. He doesn't use the word rose, raised from the dead. Normally, that's what Paul says. Jesus died and rose, or was raised. Here he says, Jesus died and lived again. Why the change? That's interesting.
He's still living.
Exactly. So this is about Jesus died and he's still alive. When you say Jesus died and rose again, that's a past event and a past event. And that's a wonderful past event. Him dying, that's a great past event. Takes away our sin. He rose again, that's a past event. And that's a good thing too, because that means he conquered death. But when you say, and lived again, this is a, what is the grammatical term? A present perfect form of the verb? I'm not sure I got that right. It means something that happened in the past and is continuing into the present. Jesus lived and still lives. It happened in the past, but is continuing in the present. That's notable. Jesus is still alive. Not just that he rose, but he rose and is still alive. And that has an implication for you and me right now on this earth. We're still connected to Jesus. He's still here. We can't see him with our eyes, but he's still here. And because he lives again, he might be Lord of both the dead and the living. We are the living. So, this has the implication, the understanding that Jesus is with us even now to help us through this earthly life. Okay, that's what Paul's talking about here, right? These last three chapters are how do you live your life now that you know you've been justified freely by Christ through God's grace? Well, Jesus is still alive. He's helping you. He's connected to you. All right. Verse 10, why do you pass judgment on your brother? Or you, why do you despise your brother? For we will all stand before the judgment seat of God. For it is written, as I live, says the Lord, every knee shall bow to me, and every tongue shall confess to God. So then each of us will give an account of himself to God. This is Paul just quoting a verse from the Old Testament to kind of reiterate, stop judging one another for eating meat or abstaining from meat, or from drinking alcohol or abstaining from alcohol, or from honoring certain days or not honoring certain days. If we had a significant Jewish Christian population in this congregation, and they asked for a Saturday service, is there anything wrong with having a Saturday service? No, I wouldn't judge that. I would say, okay, I'll have a Saturday service for you. That's fine. Or maybe instead of Jewish, I could say Seventh-day Adventists. If all of a sudden we had a bunch of Seventh-day Adventists who converted and became Lutheran and understood that, but said, you know, but we're still just a little uncomfortable with worshiping on Sunday. Can we do a Saturday service? Sure. There's enough of you. Thursday night, we have about 20. So why not do a Saturday service? If there's 20 of you, we'll do a Saturday service too. We don't pass judgment on one another. Because we will all stand before God and have to give an account to Him. He's the one we stand before, not each other. I don't stand in judgment of you and you don't stand in judgment of me. We both stand in judgment to God. Before God, right? That's where we need to be accountable. Okay.
I think the Board of Elders would have to approve a Saturday service.
No doubt they would. But you know what? We almost have a quorum here. There's four of you right here. We could make it work, maybe. All right. Can we go another 10 minutes? I think I can get through this. Is that all right?
Sure.
All right. Therefore, let us not pass judgment on one another any longer, but rather decide never to put a stumbling block or hindrance in the way of a brother. I know and am persuaded in the Lord Jesus, that nothing is unclean in itself, but it is unclean for anyone who thinks it is unclean. For if your brother is grieved by what you eat, you are no longer walking in love. By what you eat, do not destroy the one for whom Christ died. So do not let what you regard as good be spoken of as evil. For the kingdom of God is not a matter of eating and drinking, but of righteousness and peace and joy in the Holy Spirit. Whoever thus serves Christ is acceptable to God and approved by men. So then let us pursue what makes for peace and for mutual upbuilding. This is still Paul talking about the same topic in another way, trying to explain it again. So, you may understand that eating meat is fine, but don't put a stumbling block in front of your brother who is bothered in his conscience by eating meat. Because what's more important is the gospel message and having unity and having peace and joy in the Holy Spirit. That's what's most important, not whether you have the right to eat a burger or not. Okay? So, I mean, this is Paul just explaining in yet another way what he's been saying in this chapter so far. And he does bring in something here. It says, when I just read it, it says eating and drinking. There it is. Eating and drinking. So eating is a reference to meat or vegetables, you know, a carnivore or vegetarian. And drinking, yes, he's not talking about water. He's talking about alcohol. Just, we use the word drinking just like they did back in that time. So when he says eating and drinking, yes, there's the third topic he's bringing up. Some people refrain from alcohol, or it impedes their conscience. They think they shouldn't drink alcohol, or they don't have the Christian freedom to drink alcohol. Then in their presence, I would not drink alcohol. Now some people shouldn't be drinking alcohol for personal reasons, health reasons. Maybe they've been addicted to it, so recovering alcoholic, you shouldn't be drinking alcohol. For the same reason, I would not drink in their presence. I don't want to be the source of temptation for someone else to sin. Okay? So there's the third topic. Eating meat or not still applies today. Worshipping or following certain days as holy and other days as not holy still applies today, doesn't it? Drinking alcohol still applies today. This is timeless stuff from Paul. Right? All right. So let us pursue what makes for peace and for mutual upbuilding. That should be the overriding goal. So we're nearly at the end. We got one short paragraph left. I'm going to give you a little summary right now of how I would summarize all of this, which is hard to do in our sinful, fallen, selfish human state. Think of the other person first. Does God want us to do that? Yeah. Think of the other person first. That's what biblical humility is. So, before I take a bite out of my big old juicy burger and a swallow of my beer, which I love, both, okay, first I have to think to myself, and this is pretty rare in my case, is there somebody around me who's going to be offended by me eating meat or drinking alcohol? Especially if they're a fellow Christian who's weak in faith. If they are, you know what, I should forego the burger and have a salad, and I should forego the beer and have, you know, iced tea, for the sake of preserving the conscience of my weaker fellow Christian who's with me. Okay, so you think of the other person first. Now if I'm with you all, or as Pastor Yeager would say, all y'all, haven't heard that in a while. If I'm with all of you and I know you're fine eating meat and me drinking beer, I'm going to chow down that burger and have a good old beer. So, but think of the other person first. That's hard to do, isn't it? Because our natural sinful state is to think of us first. That's what we do.
So I have a vegan sister-in-law.
Okay.
She's adamant about it.
Okay.
And she's also agnostic. She thinks I'm foolish for believing that there's a God.
Okay.
You're not saying that I should forego eating what I enjoy in front of her, that that's going to help the situation?
Because some of the meals she's brought to family get-togethers, I'm not eating.
Oh, yeah. It's like some wacky, crazy quinoa, you know, nutty, crunchy kind of whatever.
I don't know what it is.
You might not like what I would say.
I know, I'm worried about that.
I would say if it has an opportunity to draw her back into faith and believing in God, if that were a possibility, and I don't know if it is or not, if that were a possibility, and you refrained from eating meat in her presence, or you actually kind of choked down some of her dishes that she brought, and because of that, it opened the door for her to kind of pause and think, well, you know, maybe Karen's got a point. Maybe I should reconsider my stance on whether God exists or not. Would you be willing to trade your freedom in eating to give a chance or an opportunity for her to come back to faith? There's your answer. Now, you're right. I would not like eating all that nutty, crunchy quinoa, granola, whatever shit is she's bringing. But I would eat it if it opened the door for the possibility of her believing in God.
So it sounds like prayer is really...
Prayer absolutely helps, yes.
Right, right. But I'm just saying, because I can't imagine me eating some of her chili dish.
Vegetarian chili? You can do one of those things where you take enough that it covers the bottom of the bowl so it looks like you're eating some, and then you still leave some behind, you eat a few bites, and yeah, the rest goes in the sink and gets rinsed out.
You can't
eat
anything else that anyone else brought.
Yeah.
But if you make a funny face when you eat it, it kind of defeats the
point. Yeah, yeah, right, right.
But anyway, so if I get any kind of feeling that it would help her see
yes.
my point of view, then.
I agree. And on the other hand, if she is so hard-hearted that she's like, there's no way God exists and there's nothing you're going to do to convince me, and you are convinced that there's no way the door is going to ever be open for her, I'd probably just go ahead and enjoy my burger. So, I mean, it's kind of, you have to judge the situation.
Each situation separately.
Correct. Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Yep. All right. Last little bit here. Do not, for the sake of food, destroy the work of God. Hey, wow, Karen, you are leading us right into that. Yeah, so if for the sake of God, if there's a chance to open the door, give up your freedom of what you eat in order to try to open the door for, if there's a chance. So you have to try to discern that. Do not, for the sake of food, destroy the work of God. Everything is indeed clean, but it is wrong for anyone to make another stumble by what he eats. It is good not to eat meat or drink wine or do anything that causes your brother to stumble. The faith that you have, keep between yourself and God. Blessed is the one who has no reason to pass judgment on himself for what he approves. But whoever has doubts is condemned if he eats, because the eating is not from faith. For whatever does not proceed from faith is sin. So those last two verses, I need a little bit of explanation there, because it's, you know, it sounds a little bit strange, perhaps. The faith that you have, keep between yourself and God. Does that mean we don't talk to other people about our faith? No. This is specifically talking about the faith you know that gives you Christian freedom. The faith, because that's the topic he's talking about here. Because you are stronger in faith, you know you can eat meat, and you can drink wine, and you can worship on any day you want. Those are his three topics, and there's more topics we mentioned. Because you're strong in faith, you have that. Well, keep that between yourself and God. God, I know I can eat meat, I know I can drink wine, I know I can have a beer, but for the sake of my brother, I'm not going to, because I don't want to have a reason to pass judgment on myself by causing my brother to stumble. Okay? That's what Paul is saying here. But whoever has doubts is condemned if he eats. So if you have a brother or sister, Christian in faith, who's weak in faith, and against his conscience or her conscience, eats meat or drinks alcohol, even though they still believe it's wrong because they're still weak in faith, you have just caused them to sin because they're going against their own conscience. the proper approach is not to force them to do something against their conscience, because after all, you have the Christian freedom to do so, so you should eat this meat. You should drink this alcohol. No, the proper approach is to help them grow stronger in faith so that they understand and their conscience becomes clear that they do, in fact, have the freedom to eat meat or drink alcohol if they want. That's the approach. Help them grow stronger. Don't thrust upon them to do what you know they have freedom to do, but they don't know they have the freedom to do it. Does that make sense? All right. Really, that's the end. So there we go. And I would sum it up like I did just a moment ago. Think of the other person first. That's kind of what Paul is saying here. Think of the other person who's weak in faith, and how can you not be a stumbling block to them, so that the gospel message is open, that they will have the willingness to listen. Okay? All right, any final questions? Yeah, Delmar.
Is this worth a share for our topic?
Oh, it probably is. Yeah. It's a little meme that Delmar has here. It says, "You better start worrying about your own sins, because God is not going to ask you about mine." Yeah, I like it. You know what? Send it to me. I'll print it and put it on my little bulletin board.
All right.
That's a good little thought there.
Keep your faith between yourself and God. I was thinking about my sister-in-law. Does that also mean it's not a time to start saying you're wrong to be a Christian? This is what I believe.
That's not what he's referring to here. Yes, we should talk to people about what we believe in our faith in God. He's talking about the faith you have that you know you have Christian freedom. This is all about the Christian freedom we know we have, but we've refrained from using that Christian freedom, eating meat, drinking alcohol, etc. And you keep that between you and God. So that portion of faith, your strength of faith that says, I know I have the freedom to eat meat, I'm going to keep that between me and God. Good. Any other questions or comments? You know, my sinuses are feeling a little bit. No, actually, it's just a dry mouth because I've been talking too much. All right, let's rise and close with the Lord's Prayer. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.
Thanks for coming. Have a good night.